Welcome to Chew the Fat. In this series, I sit down with high-performance guests and we talk about life, business, and what it takes to be at the top. This is part of my mission to raise $1 million for charity by writing a cookbook called Eat with Purpose. But I'm going to need your help. If you can share the content and leave a review, it's going to make a massive impact. And the bigger the audience, the greater the reach, and the sooner we can get to that $1 million goal. Enjoy the episode. So, Lisa... Yeah. Today we have a little brekkie tacos. I've got a guacamole on the bottom, black beans, some bacon, a little scrambled egg, and we'll squeeze over the lime. And in Chew the Fat tradition, we always cook a little dish prior to connect it to the Eat with Purpose cookbook.
I love this. It's not every day that I get cooked for in my own home then do a podcast. All podcasts from here on in shall be like this.
It's always fun to come, you know, and just first thing I do, I say hello and then just dive into your kitchen and start. Love.
But I love cooking. So mm-hmm. We generally, not in this house so much, but we generally have like big lunches and dinner parties like at least twice a week.
So oh, fun.
I love cooking.
That's so good. Lisa Messenger. Founder and CEO of Collective Hub. Welcome to Chew the Fat.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. And who else cooks me brekkie before a podcast? I love this. Welcome back same time tomorrow.
Yeah. And hey, anybody listening, don't you start to steal my idea. We do not want that. I have my first question for you. And what is the context that created the person you are today from your childhood?
The context?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I like this. I like questions that no one else really asks that make me think. The context is many things probably. I grew up on a big property, 4,500-acre property. Wow. In the middle of nowhere. So in a little town, well, outside, about half an hour outside, a little town called Cooler, mm-hmm. Which is central west New South Wales. And it was a really simple lifestyle, riding my horse every day after school, making mud pies in the creek, growing our own fruit and veggies and all of that kind of things. So I think that gave me a certain humbleness and groundedness, I hope. And then my parents got divorced when I was about, I always say three, I think it was five, sometime when I was young. And I think that early on, later, having done years of therapy around it, I think that actually taught me sort of resilience and tenacity and, you know, and many different things. So, yeah, I think there were many things that we can unpack about my childhood, and I've done years of therapy on it, so we could go anywhere you'd like to. But I think, humble beginnings and just understanding different nuances years later about what makes us grow into the person that we are today.
And on that property, was there work to be done, or was it a farm style property where there's, you know, you're ploughing the land? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, no, it was hardcore. It was we had sheep and cattle and wheat, and 4,500 acres is relatively large, although probably not if you live in outback Queensland or something. And it was a pretty simple lifestyle. And, you know, it was pre the internet. I won't give away too much of my age, but pre-technology, three channels on the TV kind of era. Yeah. But it was a beautiful community. Mm. So every single Sunday, you know, I look back now and think, gosh, we were in a very small isolated world.
How big was the area in terms of people?
So the town itself, I think the population was 800. Wow. But we were half an hour out of town, and we would have on a Sunday, it would be someone's creek that you'd have a barbecue in, and it would be an old plow disc from the tractor or whatever, from the plow, I guess, and it would be over some coals in the creek, and that's how you'd have your sausages your piece of bread. And it was kind of the same community on high rotation. Mm. And that was the life, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was very, very simple, but it was a good grounding.
And how long were you there for? Like how much of your childhood was around that area?
About the first 11 years. Yeah. And then I ended up going to boarding school in Sydney for a variety of reasons. And so that probably opened me up to, like, you know, wow, the big smoke. And that was very different, you know, and I actually repeated – year seven, I did it twice because I think I was really behind and it was also foreign to me. Mm. but I was always a little fighter. And it was that feeling now that, you know, I didn't understand at school. I was always asking, but why? And then being sent out of the classroom. Like I remember, I don't know how, still I remember my maths teacher, Mr. Kamarami, literally picking me up on my chair while I was still seated, carrying me outside the classroom, putting me down, closing the door. And I think that was my childhood. Mm. Like I got sent out of class a lot, but it's that, but why? That is the best thing that has served me so well in life being an entrepreneur, because it's that line of questioning that has got me to where I am today. So I'm really grateful for it. And I hope that the education system is more divergent than convergent, and that, you know, things start changing. I think they are. I hope they are.
It's interesting, isn't it, right? Like that is such a powerful way to be as an entrepreneur. And then however, you know, essentially doing those actions as a childhood, like that could move you away from that type of being, because you're like, okay, this is not normal, therefore I need to not be that. And it's kind of scary almost to think that there would be people who have that in them and they almost are taught out of that way of thinking.
Yeah. I think we either adopt certain traits or we rebel against them. So you're absolutely right. I think, yes, there could be people who are like, okay, this is, you know, this is the regiment, this is how I need to be, I'll color inside the lines, I'll do what they tell me to do, and that's how you go on. I definitely wasn't the smartest person in school at all academically, but I think I learned very early on sort of street smarts and doing it on my own. And it was interesting because I don't know what it was. I never went overseas until I was 19, so until after I left school. But in year 10, when I went back to boarding school, I didn't unpack my bags and I was like, I just want to leave and I want to go explore the world, which is so funny because I didn't really have anyone modeling that for me at the time. But I had this always, this innate inner knowing of there's something bigger that, you know, and it was years and years and years until I understood really a semblance of who I was, stopped living life according to other people's expectations and societal norms and started to pave my own way. But when I look back to the feeling then, it was like I just want to do something different. And in fact, as soon as I left school, most people went to university and did the thing that you do. And I got on a plane. I worked at KFC, made some money in the holidays.
Nice.
That was my first job. I remember sliding around the chicken floor in my slippery, slippery shoes, skidding on the chicken fat.
I worked at Red Rooster, so I know exactly how that feels. You've just taken me back.
I remember it so well, taking home potato whip and chips. Like it was such a treat. And like the leftovers, it's so gross. Anyway, I obviously made enough money there and I decided to go to England after school. And I remember saying to my parents, I don't want any money. I want to do this on my own. I just had this inner thing. And so I did. And my mum, true to form, gave me a packet of cough lozenges at the airport and that was it.
Nice.
Because I'd lost my voice the night before partying too hard before I left. And I did. I did 2 years pretty much on my own overseas without asking for money. And I think, I've pretty much since done it on my own and not ever asked for any handouts from anyone. So, yeah, I think I learned early on some resilience and to pave my own way.
For those who don't know, what is Collective Hub?
Collective Hub. So I actually started my first business 22nd of October 2001. And Collective Hub wasn't born until March 2013. So I had the Messenger Group for, you can call it an 11-year overnight success, 12-year overnight success, as many entrepreneurs will relate to. I was, until that time, kind of over-servicing, undercharging, being everything to everyone, although I did start in 2004 accidentally a publishing business, which we can delve into. But it wasn't until 2013 that I'd been, by that point, publishing books for a number of different people. I did a book for Toby's Estate Coffee and Commonwealth Bank and Lorna Jane and lots and lots and lots of people. But it was quite one-dimensional for me, and we'll get into that because I know we're going to talk about your book. what I decided in 2012 was I wanted to go bigger. I was like, you know, by then I was making great money. It was really a profitable business. It was actually a good business. It was very systemized and process driven, But I was kind of bored and I was comfortable. And I don't think that's a great place to be as an entrepreneur or indeed in life. And so 2012, I was like, I want to bring all of these incredible entrepreneurs and thought leaders and game changers together into one format. So I just decided, I think I'll do a magazine. And so I smooshed them all together. And so I called it Collective Hub. Collective being better together and hub kind of a meeting place, a place to bring people together. Because the idea was always to have the stories of extraordinary people within the pages, but also do a lot of live events and bring these people to life so that people could actually meet them and have proper conversations and it would be raw, real, relatable, attainable. And so, yeah, that's how that was born. And that became almost an overnight success. And I mean, I've talked about that ad nauseum, but we can dig into any and all of that if you want.
And what, as like a series of products, like what did that look like? So it was events, publishing of the magazine. Was any other ancillary products that created the Collective Hub?
So much. And Chris, who founded Pedestrian, who's a great friend of mine now, still laughs at me because I first met him in about 2014 and he reminds me continuously that I sat on a panel with him and said, yes, we have 17 extensions of the business, 17 revenue streams. Yeah. And he still says, I sat there scratching my head going, how do you maintain focus and how are you actually? Because I did. So the point of difference with launching the magazine was that, and I won't make this a long conversation, but I looked at the business model of traditional magazines and it was essentially selling a flat ad on a page and a subscription model. And the first issue of that magazine cost me $350,000. So to bankroll it, I was like, well, if I have to sell, I have to sell 35 ads at 10 grand a pop just to break even on like going to print with the first issue, or, you know, and no one knew who I was. I'd never worked in magazines, never worked in media. It was an industry people said was dead or dying and it was highly saturated. Mm. So like it was just never going to work.
Right? The perfect storm.
Yeah. So I just had to think differently from the get-go. And so what I did was I actually, the first deal I did with the magazine, which is well documented, was with Commonwealth Bank. Mm. They gave me $200,000. I've still never borrowed any money in the business to date. Very unusual, 23 years in. but that looked like kind of sponsorship, advertorial, editorial, me doing speaking gigs, ads in the mag, like a whole lot of other things. I looked at what are my tangible, saleable assets. Mm. And I teach so many people this now, like what have you got in your artillery that you can actually sell against and how can you convince someone to give you the money for that you never have to repay, unlike you who had investors. So I did that and then I was like, let's start running events. So the magazine always looked like, and in fact my main business today still looks like printed products, digital products and live events. So it was magazine, 12 issues a year. It was a couple of books a year because I started charting the journey with Daring and Disruptive, Money and Mindfulness, Life and Love, Risk and Resilience, Work from Wherever. So I started writing books in real time in conjunction with the magazine, telling the journey, because I was like, if the whole magazine is about telling the story behind the story and lifting the lid on entrepreneurship and talking about, well, how did you do that? Why did you do that? What's your supply chain? How did you get that funded? Then I thought, well, who am I to sit back there and have this thing that's, you know, rising across the globe and not talk about it? So I wrote a series of 7 books and 3 playbooks that charted that journey. If anyone wants to know about business, it is everything in there about what not to do, what to do. Every dollar I spent, like they are blueprints for that entire business. The digital side was we were doing kind of 8, which makes me laugh now, like crazy with AI and ChatGPT and Sora and everything else. We were doing 8 articles a day online. I was paying writers $400-$500 an article. Like it makes me kind of ill now thinking about the amount of money that I poured into it. But that was a big part of the business. And then our social media following, we were doing online masterclasses and things. And then physical events, we were doing up to 4 events a week.
It's huge.
Yeah, so we're doing a lot with restaurants. Mm-hmm. So we would identify who was the latest restaurant to launch in Melbourne, Brisbane, Sydney. We would do a deal with the owner and we'd say, give us 80 seats. So do all the food and bev for free. So we didn't pay for anything. It was $149 a ticket. We took that revenue, but the exchange was we would get them on the map. So we'd free promote it through the previous issue of the magazine through our social media following, which was, well, it is now about 800,000 across all platforms. It wasn't quite that then. And then we would do like a double page wrap, Think Vanity Fair style, after the event. So that was great. We did that for a long time. And then we would run masterclasses in our office. So I had a 600 square meter penthouse office in Surry Hills. Again, huge amounts of money now that we've decentralized. And so the idea there was, and I think the lessons here are about, I've always thought about value exchange and how can we trade. So we would have someone like you come in and run an, you know, run a 2-hour masterclass on food or on like, you know, a tech startup or whatever it was. We wouldn't pay you, but then we would do a story in the mag on you. So much of my business and always been trading. What can I do for you? What can you do for me? How can we collaborate? And that's how the print mag was in 37 countries within 18 months and blah, blah, blah. People can read my books, 208 pages each. There's like a good 1,000 pages of everything we did there.
I love it. There's so many things here. And I'm, what I'm conscious, and we chatted before, Lisa, is like, you know, you have shared a lot of the messages. So I want to make sure we, you know, we go on little different angles. And hopefully, as I ask the questions, they are different. And my first question is, I actually want to take that step back. It's that first meeting for Commonwealth Bank.
Oh, yeah.
And the mindset, because, you know, a lot of the audience that listen is around, you know, they're either, you know, it's that first next step, you know, so that step to take in their business, or it's the concern or worry like, oh, you know, am I ready for, you know, the conversation with Commonwealth?
Yeah.
And so I want to ask, like in your mind, like, was there any blockers, was there any things, or, you know, were you so confident that you're like, I'm going to just do this?
Combination of both. And I think as entrepreneurs or people with ideas or startups or whatever stage you're at, and indeed now 23 years in, I think it's there's some ideas, you know, I have ideas, at least 30 of them a day, where we were talking about this before, I see everything. I'm like, oh, problem. Okay, I've got a solution for that. But it's like I always look at, well, is that on purpose for me? Is that something I can feel really passionate about moving forward? Is that actually going to solve a big world problem? Like, so I ask myself certain questions before I go in. There's things that I've been super passionate about and I'll get into it, and then, you know, people will be, I'll hear more no's than yeses and I'll just end up knocking it on the head. In that particular instance, and I guess this is honed over years of, you know, setbacks and some successes, some failures, and you hone that intuition, I think. I just kept going. So before that particular meeting with Commonwealth Bank, I would have had at least, I say 79, I don't know if it was 60 or 90, different phone calls with different people trying to do a deal. And the majority of those conversations went something like, you know, who are you? Never heard of you. You don't have any experience. Nah, are you ridiculous? Prince dead or dying? Like, you know, so there was a lot of no's. The interesting thing, and I remember it so distinctly, and I felt this other times, always on the cusp of something big, the feeling was, and I actually just got complete shivers, is I remember standing on the pavement in Surry Hills before I went to that meeting, and I was getting a taxi. And I remember nearly not getting in the taxi. It's that cusp of when you know something, for me, when I know something big is potentially about to happen, there is a moment, a fleeting moment of, oh, it would be easier. Like it's almost the fear of success as opposed to the fear of failure. I was like, oh, sometimes it's easier just not. So I pushed myself in there. And the interesting thing about that meeting is I'd been stalking Andy Lark, who was the chief marketing officer of CommBank, for about 3 months prior, because I knew that he still believed in entrepreneurship a lot, but he still believed in print. And I knew that about him. And I'd been trying to get to him so many times. And I'd actually sent him, someone had said to me, I was really big on Twitter. So I remember I sent him a tweet the night before that at 10 p.m. saying, hey, Andy, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he tweeted back going, yep, let's have a coffee tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And I was like, whoa. So it happened quickly, right? And I walked into that office and I think this is really important. I walked in with just such a inner knowing and sense of purpose and confidence. I didn't have any PowerPoints. I'd sent him a deck, a pitch deck, but he never received it.
Perfect.
But I just spoke from my heart and I said, this is what I want to do. I believe so strongly in entrepreneurship. I want to tell the story behind the story. I want something that people, that lifts the lid off it. You know, there's all these behind the door conversations around, but how did you fund that? Or where do you get that made? And I was like, no one's telling it. And this is what I want to do. And he looked me straight in the eye and he was like, okay, we'll do it. How much do you need? And I was like, 200 grand. And he goes, okay, no problem. And I got in the lift and I went back downstairs and Claire, who'd been with me, she was with me 12 and a half years, I burst into tears and she said, oh, another no. And I was like, no, he said yes, yes. He said yes. And so I think what I would say on that is this, and I don't know if this is your experience, but every single time I've had any level of success, it's generally come from a big pain point, either in mostly in my life, it's been like, oh, I'm frustrated. There's no media out there that talks about this. I'm sick of having these behind the scenes. Like, I'll create it, you know. We all have the ability, if there's a big enough need in society and a burning passion within us, to create anything. And I've done it now multiple times across a number of different industries and in my own life and having a baby. We can get into that if you want. In crisis management for bushfires and floods, like I've applied the same thinking in any moment where there is a problem to be solved. And I know right on the cusp of something, I get that feeling of, and when I let myself go just over that precipice, the knife's edge, then freaking extraordinary things happen. So I would say, just if you have that feeling of uncomfortability, just push through.
It's so interesting as you talk about that, because it's like there's like those are sliding doors moments, right? It's like if I didn't, you know, if there was something in that, let's say that day's mindset or my energy wasn't right, that couldn't push me over the edge, is like so much, you know, like now we can connect the dots in the past, but so much in the future, you like it could change like so many things.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's interesting as you talk about that. I think about opportunities and I haven't thought about that intuition layer on top, but it's like opportunity sometimes, like just like pulling a thread, you don't necessarily know where it goes, but you just want to like just pull it one little bit more.
Yeah.
And then the next, just one little bit more, and like over time it will expand to somewhere.
Exactly. And I think what I would say is to people, you know, this didn't happen overnight. People are like, oh, are you born an entrepreneur? I'm like, well, it's for me, I think the intuitive or the gut feeling is honed over years of just pushing the boundaries a bit more, taking a risk a little bit more, and then kind of going, okay, I didn't fail, or I did fail, but I learned these lessons, and then pushing it a bit more and a bit more and a bit more. I mean, I take fairly large risks and they're part calculated, but a lot on gut and intuition now.
Have you, the intuition piece is really interesting, right? Like, so I've been doing a lot of reflecting on for myself, and I realize that, you know, your intuition today as we sit next to each other is far greater and different to what it was in the early days.
Oh yeah.
And for me, there was like, I had to create like a process of reflection. Essentially, it's like, oh, my gut feel was this, the outcome was X, you know, was it in line? And you had to do this through a series. Did you find you had to, was there any process you had to hone that, or it's just through the series of events that it just naturally does hone?
It's part through a series of lived experiences and events that it hones, and it's also I'm an avid reader. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I surround myself with extraordinary people, and the threads are interesting, right? Like, you start to see the signs. The whole reason that Collective Hub ended up in 37 countries was actually, I was part of EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization, back then. I went to one of their global universities in Amsterdam, met a guy who had an umbrella company, like nothing to do with anything. And he said to me, oh yeah, we're in however many countries around the world. It was such a quick conversation. I was like, oh, how did you do that? He's like, I went to a distribution fair for blah, 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 and that's how we did it. That tiny conversation that took about that amount of time, I was like, huh, okay, I've been thinking too small. So there's like lots of threads, and I think for me, I've honed the ability to listen to little things. I always, always, always look outside of my industry. I think part of what I've learned to do is be quite counterintuitive. So rather than walk the same way to a coffee shop, it can be as simple as that, walk a different route, run a different way, have a conversation with someone that you normally wouldn't, listen to a podcast in a different genre, chat to the Uber driver. Like, so I feel like I'm constantly curious and seeking. And I feel like in those moments and conversations, that's when I pull at little threads. And it might be the wildest thing. I mean, so many of my, I might already have an idea and then I'll be like, oh, that person said this or I saw that somewhere. Boom, you just pull at a little thread. No idea is a new idea, right? It's how we synthesize it really. I'm a great synthesizer. I pull lots of pieces from lots of places and then bring them together. The honed piece is, I think, and I would say listen to the similarities, not the differences. Everyone's journey is different. But having, you know, in my first year of business in 2001, you know, a lot of things would have scared me. I often talk about, and it's irrelevant what this story is, but it's like someone owed me $80 or I owed them. Like it was a small amount of money. Yeah, I can't even remember if I owed them. But I remember the kind of around it. And that's relative, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And now it could be for someone else. It could be like someone owes them $800 and it's like, but now oftentimes I might have to pay an 80 grand bill or someone owes me 80 grand. And my response to that is so much less panicky at all than it would have been back then. And that's just because I've learned to, and this is a good skill, I think, reverse engineer the situation. So I'll go, ah, okay, what's worst case scenario? Well, okay, I owe someone 80 grand, someone owes me 80 grand. Okay, interesting. And then I just quickly, I don't allow myself to hang there long. I reverse engineer it back to current moment and I go, okay, well, who are the people? Do I need to chat to my CFO, chief financial officer, or my accountant, or do I need to, you know, get a lawyer onto that? Or like, you know, what are the steps and who can help me with that? And I think it's really important. If you're a solopreneur, having a great team, if you're a, you know, CEO, having a great team around you of people who supplement your weaknesses and can support. And so not much freaks me out now. And I think that's interesting having sometimes younger staff who'll be like, oh, my God, oh, my God. And I'm like, oh, just calm the fuck. But I would have been, oh, my God, as well. But I think as we grow, there isn't room or capacity for that, or we'd be permanently catatonic in a ball rocking silently in a corner, because every day as we get bigger or take on more in life and or business, you know, more comes at us. It's not like we suddenly perfect it all. It's like more stuff comes that either is in our control, but more often than not beyond our control, be it economic or pandemics or all sorts of other things. But what we can control is our mindset and how we choose to respond.
You know what's funny? As you were talking about that, my face lit up, because only yesterday I was having a coffee with my brother and he just randomly said to me, he goes, do you remember, because we used to live together and this is when we were on paying ourselves $400 a week, and he goes, do you remember when we used to, like, it would be Monday and someone would buy the Guzman for that night's dinner and then it'd be like, hey, can you send me $12.75? And it's like exactly that, and everything kind of, you know, relatively changes. And it's like it's really funny, because that's definitely a thing in those early days. But what I love is, like, hearing you talk about is like reverse engineering, compressing, getting yourself out of that feeling and going, what are the next logical steps that I need to do to overcome this particular thing in whatever scale?
Yeah. And I think probably I'm not particularly good at anything, but I think what I've learned is, yeah, exactly what you say. What are the next logical steps? Mm. And so I'm a problem solver, and sometimes naivety coupled with good business acumen can be a really great thing, because I don't know too much. So I just ask, okay, well, what would I do now? What would I do now? What would I do now? And I mean, we can talk about various different examples, because I think it's easy for people to go, oh, well, that's all right. You now know how to run a magazine or write books or whatever. But I've applied that in a number of different ways. In crisis management, we can go into that if you want, and I can apply that same thinking and give pretty good examples.
Well, give me one. I'd love to. Yeah, please. Yeah.
Okay. So 2022, sitting where we are now, in the Northern Rivers, there were massive floods, and our house where we're sitting now, we didn't have a retaining wall out the back, and so all the house came down into the back, came into the house and whatever else. But that was the least of the problems. Like it was serious floods around Lismore and things. So I had to go stay at my mum's that night, and I was just watching the television. The reason I'm giving this example is to demonstrate that anyone can be of use if they just think about the next logical steps. And I was looking on the TV and it showed Lismore flooding and like it was really bad. And I said to Mum, oh, I've got to do something. And she said, she should know better. She does know better. But she said, oh, darling, you know, the SES will have this under control. I went into her spare room in my pajamas, jumped on Instagram and straight away found the Nuriba Hall, which is like a little local hall, said to Kerry, who runs that, hey, can I have the hall tomorrow? She's like, yep, you can have it. Jumped on Instagram, said, right, 10 a.m., Nuriba Hall, locals bring mattresses, pillows, clothing. But like, but I, at the same time, 10 o'clock at that night, I was reaching out to Brianna Casey, who's the CEO of Food Bank, who I'd already done stuff with 2 years prior for the bushfires. So boom, boom, boom. Just connected with a whole lot of local charities and people who could get stuff done. By 10 o'clock the next morning at Nuriba Hall, and it's all over my Instagram, there was cars lining up, hundreds of people bringing all this stuff in. And we became, within sort of 24 hours, the point place dealing with a lot of the local charities on, okay, we're setting up an evacuation centre at Alstonville. We need 80 mattresses, 80 pillows. And we became the point people for that, and I became the spokesperson for, you know, a lot of their area. And then a lot of other people set up other centres. Now, I don't have any experience whatsoever in crisis management, but what I do have, and I talked about this earlier, and I really urge anyone listening to this to work out what are your available skill sets or your available assets, and what can you trade, you know? So now I have a pretty sizable social media following and a pretty engaged community. So I just used what I had. So I have no idea how to set up evacuation centres or anything, but I just thought about what's the next logical step. Well, these people are in crisis. I'll reach out to the 10 main sort of charities and people who can do stuff. I can mobilize my community to bring the stuff, and then I can communicate with those people and get it out. And we did. And I did that with bushfires as well 2 years prior. So, and I did it about carrying my own baby. So
you're well skilled, you're well versed.
Yeah. So just on that, same knowledge applies as well. Just during those floods, one of the radio interviews that I did was with a guy called David on the Gold Coast, and Sarah, who's edited most of my books, texted me after and said, hey, you were just on the hubby with my radio. How's the IVF going? And she'd offered 4 years before, if you're ever struggling and you want someone to carry your baby, I'd look at being a surrogate. And literally during those floods, I texted in my vulnerable state and said, hey, still interested in being a surrogate, but the IVF's not great. And she was like, yep, let's do it. Anyway, fast forward, Hugo is now 7.5 months and Sarah ended up carrying my baby. So I just think differently and I just think about what's the next logical step. How do we solve anything? You know, the ultimate outsource, someone else carried my baby. But
it's incredible.
I believe entrepreneurs often can have a one-hit wonder, but if we can hone this thinking and apply it to business and life, then we can succeed and have impact in a number of different aspects of life.
Two questions for you.
Yes.
So what you did there for the floods as an example,
yes,
would have had a significant community impact in the positive direction.
Yes.
How did that make you feel, being able to utilize the skills of, you know, the skill that's standing out to me is the leadership skill, the ability to, you know the right people and know that next step. How did that feel being in that space and I'm sure seeing the faces of people that you're able to help?
Yeah, I mean, extraordinary. That, I mean, I think that is really my life's calling. Like that in those moments, like, and there's no money involved in that, you remove everything. It's just the most extraordinary thing. And do you know what? Any one of us can do something like that. And that's the thing, I think, when people... And we all go through stages of this. We lose our way, or we lose our identity, or we don't know what our purpose is, or we don't know what the next step is. I mean, if you're ever feeling lost, I think if you just reach out and help someone, go to a, you know, soup lighter kitchen or something and serve people lunches, or, you know, go read in an elderly person's home or anything, anything like that. We were talking about threads before. Anything like that gives you a little thread and a little spark, and you never know where it's going to lead. And the interesting thing about the floods was I did suffer burnout about 2 weeks in because I just loved it so much. Mm. Like, it was the most gratifying thing. But what happened was I'd be in the Nuri Bar Hall, like coordinating mm. and on the radio and doing the thing. And so you're running on adrenaline mm. continuously, then jumping on social media. And my whole team at the time, I pulled them off normal work because wow. we were getting like at least 800 direct messages on Instagram wow. every day. Where can I send this? How can I do this? So we became that. And then, oh God, I just remember so distinctly. Then what happened was, in the evacuation centres, and they were all over the Northern Rivers, Southern Cross University, and people were then like, oh my God, my cat or my dog, we left them behind. So one of the girls, I remember at the end of a long day at the hall and going in and out of evacuation centres, she was like, I'm going on a rescue mission to Lismore to like get this cat out of a roof. And oh. So I went with her and we just started rescuing these animals oh. and like returning them to people in the evacuation centers. Like, it was amazing. The hard thing, like the most amazing feeling of my entire life doing that kind of work in the moment, but it's very difficult mm. to transition back mm. to normal life because, and it's fascinating because I've done it twice now in a big way. People begin to rely on you. People mm. want a leader and people want a sense of belonging. And so what I've been able to do quite quickly is kind of lead and be just a point person mm. between the charities or the various bodies and say, okay, tell me what you need. Okay, I'll pump it out on Instagram. This is what they need. This is when. This is how. This is the volume. But suddenly I had to go back to, mm. well, A, I was doing IVF still, and B, I had a business to run. So I couldn't continue mm-hmm. on, you know. Reality happens. But exiting from that space and then going back to, oh, shivers, now I use my Instagram to post pretty pictures of myself again. Like, it's a very hard transition, and you can – I did feel like, oh, my gosh, I'm letting people down. How do I transition back, and how do I almost make excuses or, like, I was overcompensating. Oh, sorry, guys, I've got to go back to this. But that's a reality, and I think that's a tricky thing with crisis management or anything. How do you transition out of that back to I actually need to make money or run my business, or I have a whole team that relies on me as well. I can't stay in this forever.
Of course.
Yeah.
And we didn't touch on it there, but I've heard through, you know, listening to you, was it 30 rounds of IVF?
No, that would have been a lot. I did 16 rounds 16, of IVF.
Sorry, 16. It's 38 books, sorry. No, so 16 rounds.
Yeah.
What was that moment of getting to bring Hugo home for the first time?
Like, unbelievable. Like, we're going to have to do it 2 episodes out because we haven't even started talking about book stuff. I have time. It was extraordinary because, again, everything's relative, but I had been through a miscarriage. I'd tried to adopt a baby in Bali for a long period of time. I did 2 rounds of IVF with donor sperm years ago, met Stephen, tried naturally, went on to do another 14 rounds of IVF, and then ultimately Sarah, one of my great friends and editor of many of my books, ended up carrying Hugo. So, like, it was a big journey. Emotionally, physically and financially. Yeah. So, yeah, it was pretty wild. So I caught Hugo, which is a really beautiful thing when you're not actually birthing the baby yourself. You can. So I delivered him straight from Sarah, and Stephen cut the cord, and it was just like, you know, the greatest miracle on the entire planet. So, yeah, sometimes I still can't believe he's here. Yeah, really, 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 really special.
And it's really, it's interesting how these things tie into business as well, because again, it's like, you know, if a person gives up at a particular part of the journey, they don't get to get that outcome. You know, they're like, I even though we condense that in a minute, I like can't even fully appreciate the tax that would create on you, but then the sense. And I can see it in your eyes, like that satisfaction and that just pure love that you got at the end of there by just pushing through, by, you know, doing whatever it takes to get that outcome. Mm. And I can just see your face, you know, as today, as we talked about Hugo, it just like lights up.
Yeah.
And it warms my heart. Like, it's so beautiful.
Thank you. Well, our kids will have to meet. Yeah, but I think it is the same in business as well, or in anything in life. Right, it's yeah. like if I remember Stephen saying to me at one moment throughout the journey when I was, you know, having a pity party in the corner, and he was like, it doesn't matter if we spend $1 or $1 million. You know, if this is what we want, we just do it. And I think I actually never shared about the journey, even though I'm the great open book, I never shared about the journey at all publicly until about round 15 or 16, I think, maybe 16, because it was just so excruciating and I learned to compartmentalize my life in that way. But the reason that we've shared the journey so publicly is kind of for that reason. I think there is so much there's so many problems with fertility, and I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, there are so many options. You can have donor sperm, donor eggs, you know, surrogate. Like, there's so many different ways now that you can do it. And in fact, so many people thought that surrogacy in Australia was illegal. So we've really shone a light quite purposely on that, just because so many people said, you've really helped, I didn't realize. And my story is my story. Again, you know, people might want to give up or stop at a certain point, or, you know, various things might not be an option for them. We were in a fortunate position, which I don't take lightly, years of working our butts off, that we were able to actually pay for it. And it was a very expensive journey. It was closer to the $1 million than the $1, let me tell you. But you know, at the end of the day, what's most important to us? We wanted a beautiful child, and we have a beautiful child. Everything else kind of falls into, you know, the abyss, really. It's not that important.
100%. So let me shift gears a little bit. I'd love to kind of start to drill on those insights around, you know, the self-publishing of the books.
Yes.
38 books you've authored.
Yes.
What is your biggest insight that you learned from, you know, if you compile them all together and you go, like, these are the lessons I've learned in either life, business, whatever it is, what are those?
So the word self-publishing, I don't love.
No.
Perfect. Yeah. Leave it in there. Yeah. It's great. It's great. The reason is I just want to shift the conversation around that, because initially I did self-publish in 2004, my very first book, Happiness Is. Do you want to? We need to go into like a lot of this. Yeah. Do you want to? You need to do two episodes.
Yeah, I'm jamming. We're having fun.
Like, I'm happy to keep going.
Please.
Because I feel like this is a big whole useful other thing. All right, let's do it. Edit as you will. Okay, so 2004, I was very unhappy, 20 years ago. And I just had this yearning. So again, this plays into everything we've talked about. When you're in an uncomfortable place, like anyone who's listening to this, I swear to God, hone in on that, because that, if you can let yourself, that in my experience every single time is when something extraordinary happens, and it's as uncomfortable as hell at the time. So I was drinking too much. I'd alienated my family. Like, I'd started my business 3 years before, overservicing, undercharging, was burnt out. Like, my life was actually a real train wreck. So I decided I want to write a book on happiness. Like, I want to go and find out from everyone I can, what does happiness mean? So I literally did a half day self-publishing workshop and a half day publishing workshop. Beautiful. That was the extent of my knowledge.
Quick question, and this is really interesting for people, regardless if they're going to be publishing a book but just doing business.
Yes.
I'd love to know between that idea and the execution of the first step, which is the self-publishing workshop, how long did it burn away from you before you went, okay, here, I'm going to do it?
Well, it's really funny we're having this conversation 20 years on from me publishing my first book. When I travelled, we talked about when I was travelling around for 2 years straight after school, the funny thing was, and that was several years before, I had started writing a compilation cookbook then. Because I was like, oh, all these great restaurants and travelling and things. So, like, I think the idea of a book had been like playing around in my mind for years before this point. And I don't know, I think I was just so desperate to find out what happiness meant that I was just like, I don't even really remember why. It was just like, I'm going to go and ask everyone and put it into a book. So I did that. And what I learned in summary in those two half days was, if you go with a traditional publisher, and I'm putting this out there, I don't know if this is quite correct, don't quote me, but it's something like 1 in 4,000 unsolicited manuscripts. Mm. So people just sending random manuscripts to a publisher actually make it to a published book. So the stats aren't great. Mm. Most traditional publishers take at least 18 months to, you know, maybe 4 years mm. to put the book out. And whilst they underwrite the cost, generally you'll end up making like $1.30 a book or something. Yeah. And a bestseller in Australia, again, don't quote me, depends who you talk to, is 5,000 copies. Most books sell about 300 copies. So the publishing industry very much works on, you know, almost like throwing stuff at a wall. Mm-hmm. We'll put, you know, 50 books out and two of them might stick and be great. The others, well, they just didn't work. But the two that worked, worked really well. Yes. So that's what traditional publishing traditionally looks like. Self-publishing, on the other hand, is you underwrite the costs yep. yourself up front, but your speed to market is, you know, as fast as you want to work. You essentially write the book, edit it, proofread it, design it, fact check it, go to print, land a product, boom. So it's a much faster process and you stand to make a lot more money. Mm. So, you know, blah, blah, we can go into that. So I decided, oh, I don't have time to wait. I'm like this, you know, A-type control freak personality. I just want to go. Yeah. So I decided to do it myself. And what I did, and this thinking is exactly how I still 20 years later think in business all day, every day, is I thought about, you've heard me say this a few times already, like what are my saleable tangible assets? Mm. So what I did was I pre-sold that book based on just a 10-page pitch deck.
Mm.
The book wasn't yet done. So I had the cover and I had some indicative internal spreads of this is what the book will look like. I then thought differently and I went out a bit like the Commonwealth Bank deal. I went, this is literally my process. Let's go through the alphabet. Automotive, airlines, accommodation. I think about every category and then I think about companies within those. And then I go, okay, where is there a fit?
Mm.
So with my book Happiness Is, there was a perfume called Happy Hearts that was put out by Clinique. And I was like, right, I didn't know what a gift with purchase was back then, GWP. But I was like, oh, surely they can buy copies to give away with the perfume. So they pre-purchased 2,000 copies, helped me to cash flow. Those 2,000 copies went into Meyer and David Jones. They had big posters saying buy a bottle of Happy Hearts, get a free copy of Happiness Is. So it did my advertising for me. And then I just went through the categories. I thought, automotive, what's the problem they're trying to solve? They have people that are going to do test drives. They want to incentivize test drive. Imagine going, which I did another deal with Mercedes for a few thousand copies. Imagine going and test driving a Mercedes and they go, oh, thank you for test driving. Here's a beautiful book on happiness. Mm. So I did deal after deal after deal before I'd gone to print. So I bankrolled it again like that. Officeworks, I used to get their catalogs in the mail and it would be like, spend $200 with Officeworks, get a free yoga mat.
Yes.
I literally cold called, hey, who buys the yoga mats? Spoke to them. They're like, oh yeah, send us your thing. They bought 10,000 copies of my book. And I remember the call, it's nothing to Officeworks, nothing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They were like, oh, hi, we'd like to take 10,000. We'll pay $7 a unit. I was like, oh, okay. So the maths on that, coming back to publisher versus self-publishing, is the book cost me, when you're talking about high volume, it probably cost me about $2 to $3 to print.
Yep.
Even though I'm getting $7 a unit, because I've already done the print runs, I've already paid for all of the fixed costs. So I've paid already for my time to write. I've paid for the editor, fact checker, proofreader, design. So I'm only, when I'm printing that 10,000 copies for Officeworks, I'm only paying the print and shipping costs. So even though it's only $7 and the book retailed for $39.95, I'm still making great money, right? So this is why self-publishing, as we call it, I call it now. It's funny because people say to me, oh, that's sweet, you're a self-publisher. We've done I don't know. I said the other day 2.5 million, but I think I checked with my CFO. I think it's more like 4 million copies product now.
That's actually really interesting. Do you know what else is interesting? The Eat With Purpose cookbook. It's part of my mission to raise $1 million for charity. This podcast is part of that goal. And what you can do is like, comment, share, and leave us a review. Let's get back to the guest.
And so after Happiness Is, the funny thing that happened was that sold 36,000 copies in the first
book. Which is incredible for your first book.
but it was like, I mean, we can get into all the semantics. Mm. A lot of what we do is not captured, and this is a problem with the publishing industry because there's something called Nielsen Book Data. They only record books that go through bookstores. So if anyone looks at our volume, they'd be like, oh, you don't do much. Most books, I mean, my Daily Mantras book sold over 200,000 copies in Australia alone. But most of that is what we call special sales. So I do a lot of corporate deals, special sales, a lot of speaking up the back of the room. So when we say self-publishing, I'm like, yeah, well, we actually do it much more volume than most traditional publishers in Australia in a year. And now in the US, we're in 40 physical states in gift stores, bookstores, you know, fashion stores all through the US. So the volume that we move and the profit that we make generally, I mean, we're in a bit of a downturn at the moment, but generally is insane. And so a lot of the traditional publishers have come to me on high rotation over the years saying, hi, can we have your backlist? Hi, can we publish? And I'm like, no freaking way. I make way too much money and my speed to market and I've got like insane distribution channels throughout Australia. There's practically not a gift store you wouldn't go into and see one of our products. And anyway, so from Happiness Is.
Can I pause us there for one second?
Yes.
Because what I want to share for everybody listening, right, is just to help contextualize, because someone's like, oh, Frank, I'm not writing a book tomorrow.
However,
what you've just talked about there is exactly the right way to be thinking about a minimal viable product.
Yes.
And like your idea there, which is, hey, I've got this concept. This is what the book will be, but here's the 10 pages that I can articulate it. And then I can pre-shop. So that might be in the form of investors. I like you. We were self-funded to the end, so I quite like that. I like that process, and so you know the idea there is like you know essentially getting your first customers or and reducing the risk. So yes, you are you know air quotes taking on the risk, but by having it ready to go and having it pre-sold by launch, your overhead risk is greatly, if not completely, diminished. Yeah. And I think that is just so key for everybody to hear because that's amazing. I love it.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. It is irrelevant. And that's why I say listen to the similarities, not the differences, because what I do with, you know, books or products, I've done with multiple businesses. I am a big believer in, you know, pre-selling a concept, but unlike a lot of people who get investors, I actually just, you know, do it in other ways and find distribution channels or channel partners or corporates to underwrite the cost. And it's a way of de-risking. And I've done it forever. And I'll give you another quick example in a completely unrelated, but maybe foodie travel. I talked about this years ago and I've mentored people across multiple different industries in multiple different ways. So it can be this simple. It's like a friend of mine years ago said, I'm lost. I don't know what to do. I was like, what are you passionate about? He's like, food and travel. And I was like, cool. Okay. So put up onto Facebook now, like, do you want to run foodie travel tours to Bali? He's like, amazing. You know, boom. Okay. Yes. So when we talk about MVP, minimal viable product, like I don't go away at that point and do as many people do, you know, write laborious business plans and slice and dice it within an inch of its life. At that point, I'd be like, great, let's test the market. Mm. So all I know at this point is I want to run foodie travel tours to Bali. Pop it onto Instagram or Facebook or wherever you've got some kind of a following and test the market and go, hey, are you interested in a foodie travel tour to Bali? If the market comes, and this is how I run every aspect of my business or how I launch businesses or whatever it is, when the market comes back and goes, wow, yeah, I'm interested, only then do I ever go, oh, okay, cool. Then I do back of the envelope, okay, what would that cost? Okay, well, the travel component would be this, the foodie bit. Oh, yeah, I think 4 days. Then I'll go back and go, cool, it's would you pay $4,000 for this? That's as quickly as I do it.
Love that.
And then they go, oh, no, that's too expensive. Oh, okay, boom, boom. Or, yeah, cool, that's great. Then I will do minimal work on it. Okay, let's start selling it. Great, we got two people. Shit, now we actually better work out how we're doing this. So I run everything like that. And if people follow me across any of my social platforms, you'll often see I'm testing something. Hey, guys, what do you think of this? It's most things I don't develop in any real depth until I've tested the market at the absolute minimum kind of point and I've got the interest. And then I'll quickly run behind the scenes and be like, okay. So any and all of my books always sell based on cover, some internal spreads, and I do all the deals mostly before I've written a word, you know.
Okay.
And I've done that with so many different businesses or ideas over the years. I call it vaporware, you know, create it, then like sell it and then go, ooh, better make the thing and let's hope it works.
It's I love that you're sharing this because that is a trap I see a lot of people get into is like you go down all of the permutations and steps and analysis paralysis.
Yes.
Then you go and test the market. The reality is like a lot of those steps could just be cognitive load and a waste of time.
Yep.
And before actually getting the feedback that someone will buy, like just don't waste your time. Like first try and see what is the next logical step to find out is this idea worth going past the gates and then through the series of time, then each time I have different little testing phases, like to your point, will you pay for it?
So it can be
a great idea, but maybe someone won't pay for it. And it's like creating those tests. It's very, very cool.
And it's imperative. I mean, if you think about, you know, how quickly technology, well, I mean, so many external factors, right? Technology is moving so quickly. I mean, AI, ChatGPT and now Sora and like, you know, we always thought, I think as business people, oh, well, you know, it'll be the jobs that are kind of, you know, can be replaced by robots that are just the manual, whatever. No, it's creative industries. It's writers. It's videographers. It's photographers. It's modeling. It's so many things have changed so rapidly. So I think a lot of people where they make the mistake is they spend, I see it every day. They spend so much time laboring over the idea and getting it right and getting this squeaky business plan. And they've spent all their time, a lot of their money. And by the time they're ready to go to market, the market's moved on or technology has moved on or someone else has come into the marketplace. So I think, you know, speed to market, testing, iterating, and everything I've launched, it has never landed in market in the, you know, in the way that it looked in its infancy.
Yes.
Like it's iterated, you know, 50, 100 times before it actually hits the market. So I think it's really, and why wouldn't you? With technology these days, we can test in real time so quickly in social media or in person or whatever it happens to be. There are so many different ways to test it and see if people are willing to buy it before we even start to create, really.
And the overlay I want to add there, so let's say someone is listening, is like, oh, but, you know, Lisa, I don't have a following, right?
Yes.
And a prime example of what you're just sharing is, well, you can do a very small dollar value of ads on like a, you know, a pre-sale landing page, right? Then you don't need, you can, you're broadening your network, you can put it into the particular niche, and I'm talking like 50s and hundreds of dollars, not a huge amount, to do the similar kind of concept before someone has a following. So there is always a pathway to do exactly what you've just suggested.
Yeah, exactly. Or channel partners. So oftentimes, I mean, I'm working with a lot of startups and they're in exactly that position. They're like, but I have no following, I have no brand, no one knows who I am. So I'm like, well, that's when you need to find like-minded non-competing businesses that actually share similar audiences that can amplify you quickly. Have a conversation with them. Like, so sometimes you want their database, you want their audience, right? So it's audience sharing. So you need to convince them.
Yep.
So for example, when I launched the magazine, we didn't have a social media following. I mean, I don't even think social media was 2013. I mean, it was in its infancy. But what I did was rather than think always dollar figures, when I was talking about going through the ABC, I identified people like Xero. So I knew, okay, they have a lot of, I'm talking about the accounting software. Yeah. They have a lot of small business owners, startups, entrepreneurs, my audience.
Perfect.
Telstra, and they were saying, we have 800,000 small business owners. You know, so a lot of these people, I didn't go after them for dollars. I didn't even ask about that. I asked about, I want to get to your database, you know. I mean, this we're talking about beyond MVP stage now. But it's about how do we quickly tap into other people that already have our audience and what can we trade? Because a lot of people say to me, you're absolutely right, oh, but I don't have. You all have something. You have intellectual property. You can offer to write blogs for them, or you can offer to go and speak to their staff, or you can, you got to really think about what are the things that I can sell? What can I trade so that I can tap into these databases or other people? So there are multiple ways to do it. And I think for anyone listening saying, oh, but I don't have, just remember none of us had. When I started any iteration of anything, I didn't at one point have a brand or an audience or a following or an anything. What I had was, well, what can I trade? What am I good at? Like, what can I do?
Yes.
And that's what we really need to, that's where the self-belief piece comes in. You got to think about, how can I convince someone to promote me, to amplify this, because I don't have an audience yet? What can I give them in exchange? And that's where business is fun. Yeah.
I love that. You jazz me up. Now, Lisa, one of my selfish questions I always ask, and it's, you've made it very easy for me today, is around, I look at the person I'm interviewing, their skill sets, and I think about the Eat With Purpose cookbook and I go, okay, how does their brain think? And we do a bit of a live spitball.
Yes.
Today is perfectly timed because yesterday I sat down with my brand team, Rival, and they delivered me three brandscapes of the Eat With Purpose cookbook.
Yeah.
Now, you haven't seen them, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up my laptop. I want to share with you, and I want you to be so honest.
Yeah, I will be.
And I want, this is, I guess, the first iterations. There's three versions of them, of the cover.
Yeah.
What I would love for you is just anything that comes to your mind, whether it be, the audience for your knowledge that I'm trying to sell to is like high-performing people who are health conscious and time poor.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where the branding has come from.
Yeah, me, you're selling to me.
Exactly. And so I would love you to have a look and then kind of live, you know, running through. Now, we don't want to ruin it for the audience because they're not getting to see. This is all part of the fun. But kind of a sense of, how you think it looks and feels and, what it's missing. And I have a favourite one. I won't tell you till the end.
This is beautiful and I need to drive a Mac, so somebody help me. Yeah. So first one, the cover is beautiful. Am I allowed to say what it is?
No.
Oh, well, it looks like a coffee table book, so yes, it's very clever because this is what people are very much into now. And looking at the aesthetic of where we're currently sitting, I'm all neutral palettes with this is. So it's clever because it serves two purposes. One is it's going to look beautiful on a coffee table anywhere. People will buy it even if they don't want to cook a recipe, but hopefully they open it up. And it also looks beautifully designed inside. Lots of clean white space, which is good.
Now, this is the persona of the character. No, I'm not going to be randomly selling that man.
Oh, okay. Because that is not you.
Yeah, that's right. Move this over here. Sorry, everybody. We're going a bit off-piece today.
Yes.
Here, I'll keep scrolling for us. This is a little fun little sleeve.
Sleeve is okay. Good.
And then these are just some of the assets and the way it like be delivered through socials using this particular brandscape.
Uh-huh.
And these little the secret giveaway kind of things to all tie it in with the Eat With Purpose branding.
Yeah, nice.
Okay. All right. Scape two.
Yeah.
I'm so curious to know which one's going to be your favorite. Okay, scape two.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'll pause there.
Yeah.
What's our feeling of scape two?
I like it. I think scape one is...
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, but let's keep going.
Yeah, cool.
I feel like how much can I say without giving away?
No, no one gets to see the end state right now, so all of the little bits and pieces you go with, it's great. So don't worry.
Yeah, but I'm going to pull it all apart at the end.
Yeah,
so,
perfect.
Okay.
Cool, and then the same little assets.
Yeah.
This is like another like a giveaway with it.
Yeah, great. Yep. No, definitely scape one for me so far.
Cool, okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, and then scape three.
Yeah. Ah, how funny. Very
similar. That's why we're like, when we saw your one.
Can I talk about that colour?
Yeah, of course you can.
Okay, so we're looking at a black cover. Having done Collective Hub MOOC, so not quite a mag, not quite a book, with a black cover, it does get dirty quite quickly, particularly if we're using it in the kitchen.
Very good.
I mean, I love it, but I think, and again, white space, clean, beautiful, quite masculine. I think definitely number one, the number linen one is probably the way to go.
Awesome.
Love some of what you've done here, though. Yeah, amazing. Okay. Exciting.
So now let's...
But now why don't you ask me everything about your book and how I would market it, because that's useful.
Yeah. So we know which scape you like. I would love to
which
know...
Which one do you like?
So I interestingly love scape two. And I'll explain to you the why. So it's interesting. You had one of the books today, which Kai said, oh, this one, the little Byron Bay one.
Yeah, yeah.
I liked the it's still the coffee table and then the like art and some of the messaging behind the I guess let's call it a little artwork on top would need to be refined. And then I quite liked the way in which the other one debossed, and so it could be lost that you see the front cover where that one is that right balance, I thought, between like bold and beautiful with still enough negative space.
Yeah, nice. And I tend to agree. Now, we were talking about the Byron Bay book, which is Aceline.
Yes.
So what I believe about books is there's two parts. One is and, you know, this is like anything, again, in business. One is like the production and the landed product, which people get very excited about. And two, which is more important really, is how the hell do we get it out there? Like what is the marketing? What's the distribution? Mm, mm. How do we sell this thing? If you look at Aceline, I mean, they've got an extraordinary brand now. Mm. I would like to look back to when they first launched number one of that brand. Like I think part of why it works is it's so aesthetically pleasing now and people know the brand.
Yes.
They've done Byron Bay and, you know, like they've done so many different iterations of it and it's just so recognizable. And I really do believe if you look at any great brand that was never a great brand to start with, again, it's almost irrelevant. Like it becomes, oh, my God, that book, we've got to have that book. Mm-hmm. So I think, maybe number two is bolder, it's something that will be recognizable, it's still something beautiful, but it has the poppiness. Yeah, maybe we go with that.
Okay. So now talk to me about the marketing. So how would you solve the problem I have, which is something you've solved many times, which is around the distribution and thinking about from the lens and context. It's for high performers. It's a cookbook. It's a little bit about business in there. And the distribution, of course, is not going to be in bookstores that I have access to.
Yeah.
It's through, you know, an audience I'm creating.
Yeah, amazing. So the smartest way, and I don't know if you've already done it. I mean, part of what you're doing is very smart, like doing podcasts and building audience and, you know, collaborating with people who've already got, you know, existing followings and things, and that's really going to build the brand before you release, which is great.
Awesome.
A clever model, I think, with cookbooks, and it's been done a few times, although it may not be what you're doing, is to, and I've done this, let me unpack this. I'll talk to you about a book I did, Property Investing, mm-hmm. The Australian Way. So most people are the guru of something and then they write a book. I'm like, great, I am investing in property. I'm going to write a book on how to do this. So I always do it in real time, and property is something you understand. I did a book years ago, Property Investing, The Australian Way. And I'll make this relevant to your cookbook but also to the audience in terms of how I think. I was like, what are the stages you go through in investing in property? Well, you need, you know, a mortgage broker, you need a bank, you need a blah, 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 all the people. I then went out and got category exclusivity and I gave them a chapter each. And the sell was, so it was like, I think, Rain and Horn. Like I had 10 different chapters, all the people that you need that you go through in order to buy a property. The sell to them was, all of you, I want you to commit to buying 1,000 copies. So straight away I knew there's 10,000 copies and I said, I don't want you to sell this book. I want you all to give it away.
Yeah.
So that you're cross-pollinating audiences. So the 1,000 copies that went to Rain and Horn, they're promoting the other 9 people in the book, et cetera, et cetera. So that book, so that's just another way that fund. So in terms of your cookbook, I would probably have done like at least 10, 20 recipes in collaboration with the podcast guests and said, Lisa, you've got like your recipes in there. I want you to commit to like buying 500 copies and getting it out to your audience or doing it with, you know, restaurants and things. So given you're already touring, interviewing people with the podcast, I would have been shooting you and I cooking, I would have put that in the book and I would have said, Lisa, buy 500 copies.
Yes, love that.
So that's one way I would do that, because talking about the pre-sales and let's say you're doing, I mean, you could do a whole book like that, by the way. Mm-hmm. You could do, I'm going to interview 40 people from around the world like we're doing now. Mm. Those 40 people are all going to buy, you know, 500 copies. Mm. Boom. Pre-sold, underwritten, distribution channel done. That's it.
You can love do that for you your think, next Lisa. Book. That's so good.
So that's one. But if you haven't done that. So here's something that I did years ago. When I was helping people to publish, so I said I did the Toby's Estate Coffee book and everything else, I worked with a cafe and this guy came to me and he wanted to put together a book. And I thought about going through the alphabet again, A to Z. I was like, where could we do an alignment here? So we ended up pre-selling. Mm. Again, based on this is what the cover will look like. Here's 10 pages of internal spreads. Energy Australia bought 50,000 copies of that book, pre-sale, before we'd even gone to print. I mean, that was a huge, huge deal. The reason was Energy Australia is selling an intangible. It's very hard. They're selling something that people can't touch or feel or have, you know, that doesn't really resonate deeply. So my idea was, well, we take this chef and we take this cookbook and Energy Australia does a customer acquisition and a customer retention piece. So purchase this book and don't purchase this book. Sign up with Energy Australia again or whatever else and get a copy of this book and then the chef would do, you know, recipes and blogs and live events. So we built this whole brand around it. But, I mean, that was a multi-million-dollar deal. That was a big. That was a lot of money in that. So that's where. That's how I think differently, right? So for you, I think I would be thinking a few different things. Direct to consumer.
Yeah.
So through your existing audience base, which you will have built to be even larger by the time it comes out in October, then I would think about special sales through corporates. So again, you can use my A to Z, A, B, C. Like, who would potentially buy bulk copies of this and why? Think. Hotels, you know, does someone want a beautiful copy in the hotel by their bed to flick through because it's a beautiful coffee table book? Think real estate agents. Do a great deal with a massive chain of real estate agents. And, I mean, everyone gives you a bottle of champagne when you buy a house or rent a house. So, here, have my beautiful book. So do bulk deals through corporates. And then the third would be, you know, traditional channels, bookstores. Bookstores, I always say, are a great PR exercise. Yeah. It's good to be out there. They don't make you much money. They'll take about 67% when you go through a traditional distributor. Yeah. So you can use someone like Brumby who will do traditional distribution into bookstores, or you can use someone like Halation who I use to do all my gift store stuff. So, yeah, so consumer, corporate and wholesale. They're your kind of three channels.
Amazing. That was, for everybody there, I was very selfishly wanting to hear that. So thank you, Lisa. I have one last question for you. Looking back at everything that's been and this incredible business journey that you've been on, as well as life, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of, for me personally, I think it's that I really have a very strong semblance of who I am. And I think when I'm the greatest version of me, I can really impact a lot of other people. So I always say that I am an entrepreneur for entrepreneurs, living my life out loud, showing anything's possible, and that every single day when I'm having a pity party or I think things are hard, I think, well, why am I doing this? And it keeps me accountable. It keeps me pushing the boundaries and living my best life and, you know, proving and showing other people that anything's possible. And for that reason, I've chosen to be a pretty open book, because I realize when we're vulnerable and, you know, we can, and when we share stories, we can help so many other people. So I'm proud of how I've consciously chosen to live my life. And I actually have this tattooed on my arm now, Rise, Illuminate the World. I got my first tattoo a few weeks ago.
Lovely.
And I really, you know, Hugo is my kind of reason for being now. You know, I look at this little man every day and I'm like, I want to be the very best version of me and shine and be joyous. And, you know, life throws us curveballs, but if I can learn to tackle them, you know, with dignity and grace whatever comes and teach him to be a good human, then that's a pretty good place to start.
Amazing. Lisa, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute privilege.
Thank you, Frank. I've loved every minute.